This is an oral history recording. On Friday, the 16th of December, 2016, with Elizabeth Wells, archivist.
Tom Edlin, Old Westminster and history teacher.
Virginia Lindley, though Dickinson at the time.
Virginia, can we start off by just learning a little bit about your family background?
My parents were both writers. My father was a poet and also worked with the BBC. My mother was a poet and editor of a number of things, but decided to give up poetry when she had children because she realised nothing was ever going to happen. I have an older brother who is the main cause of the whole affair because he ended up as praefectus at Westminster. And it was all his fault the whole thing ever happened.
How much older than you is your brother?
2.5 years.
And what is your earliest memory of the school?
I was often taken to plays, concerts. I even got into Little Khmem one year near the end of my brother's time, which was absolutely marvellous. I loved the buildings, I loved the place, but it was all pretty mystic, really. I had no idea why anyone was going anywhere, but they always seemed to be an awful lot. There was also the slightly unfortunate fact later, I went for private English coaching before I came to the school with John Field because he was a family friend, and I came up once a fortnight for singing lessons in London, and then I went to him for private tuition. And because I had also been taken to his flat by my brother on various visits, I thought the normal way from John's flat back to Martin Rogers' house was through the dormitories. So that was what I always did. And after a bit, once I was there, Martin said to me very kindly that he thought perhaps it would be better if I went a different way round.
So where did you first go to school yourself?
I was at school before coming to Westminster at Rye Grammar School. I was brought up in Rye, and it was a nice, small, local grammar school, and did me very well because I could be a day pupil and dash home for lunch, until the final year when it was being converted into a comprehensive, which was absolutely awful. And I ended up with one English teacher who was not very clever and one who was super, but he was also the headmaster, and he was so taken up with all the bureaucracy and mess that basically he never came to lessons to teach us at all. And after about a term of this, I just went to him and found him in his study and banged on the door and said, "Here, we're doing done, aren't we?" And got private lessons, because otherwise I wouldn't have been taught anything at all. And that got me through A-level. But I must say the change to the level of teaching at Westminster was absolutely stunning, because from 1.5 teachers, I suddenly had 5 top-flight teachers who expected a lot of work. I have never worked so hard in my life. Oxford was easy-peasy after that.
And how did you come to go to Westminster then?
Ah, brother again. He was by then praefectus, and for the college concert that summer term, they were short of violinists. And I played the violin, and my brother, in his usual way, just said, "Oh, she'll come and do it. That's all right." So I did. And it was great fun. And I seem to remember very often occasions at Westminster ended up with a perfectly splendid champagne party. As did this. And several of us were still chatting round the kitchen table. And Martin, when I said, Martin Rogers, that is, when I said, "Well, you know, I don't really know what's going to happen because my school doesn't do university entrance, because it was still the point at which Oxford and Cambridge had their own exams. And he said, oh, well, you'd better come here then. And I took absolutely no notice. I didn't think he was serious at all. In the summer holidays, I was then taken by friends to their place in Portugal and got a frantic telegram from my father saying, are you going to Westminster next term? So I sent one back saying, well, I don't know. Am I? And it seemed that I was. But unfortunately, my flight back was 3 days after the beginning of term. So I made a very dramatic entrance by coming in chauffeur-driven rolls to the gates of Dean's Yard somewhere after midnight. And John Field was there to greet me and take me in and showed me where I was sleeping in the Rogers' house and said very firmly as he left, Henry IV, Part 1, by 11 o'clock tomorrow, and put the book down on the table. So that was where it all came from.
Can you tell us a bit more about the logistics of being a girl in a boys' school and where you were sleeping, where you were working, how you fitted into the space?
I was sleeping in the Rogers' spare room upstairs, which actually connected so conveniently straight through a laundry area and into all the dormitories and boxes. I was there just as a sort of personal guest. And the logistics were wild because, of course, all my contemporaries were already in the English Seventh. So they knew where they were going for lessons. They knew to whom. They knew for what. I had no idea at all, and nobody bothered to tell me. So, the first morning I saw everybody was going across yard, and I thought, oh, well, perhaps I'd better go, and ended up in Abbey. Thought, well, there you go. And then after that, somebody did send a runner and say where I should be for the first lesson. And after that, of course, I knew who the other classmates were, and they were very kind, and they shepherded me about for a bit. But it was a pretty steep learning curve. And then, of course, there was lunch. Nobody told me about that either. So, again, I just followed the drift and waited. And then when I went in, I discovered on my first day that I was supposed to dine on the top table with college. And I had to walk right through the middle of them all, with all of them looking. That was slightly awe-inspiring. But I don't know, I think when you're young, you just take it as it comes, you get on with it, you do what you can do. There were other excitements, like one day everybody was not wandering over to Abbey, but going somewhere quite else. And I found myself in Latin prayers. So that was very entertaining, because the pronunciation of Latin at Westminster is just a little bit strange. But I was given a piece of paper that had it all on, so you did that. And then went to lessons. As far as sort of survival goes, I breakfasted myself in the Rogers kitchen. Lunch was in the dining place, as was supper. But I could raid the kitchen at the Rogerses any time I wanted. They were really, really kind and very welcoming. And I babysat on occasion just to sort of maintain the quid pro quo. And I worked in my own room, in my bedroom. So that was how that worked.
Can you tell us a bit more about the lessons themselves and what it was like being in that class with those boys?
It was pretty astonishing to start with. I think I was very lucky in that the first lesson I had was indeed with John Field, whom I knew. I think I kept very, very quiet. Probably next was with Jim Cogan, whom I had also met. But again, you see, that was somewhere completely else. So it was puzzling. As far as the intellectual side went, once I simmered down a bit, it was perfectly manageable, but very stimulating and very hard work. There was Alan Howarth, who I think taught us in a downstairs room in Liddell's, if that's where Stephen Lushington was, whom, curiously, I also knew, because my father did a lot with the BBC and he had used Stephen's wife as a poetry reader in programmes. So that wasn't too foreign. And then there was dear Mr. Christie, who took us for Browning and said, "You will all hate this, but it's very good for you. Read it now, and when you're about 80, as I am, you will enjoy it. I haven't got there yet, I must say." But we dutifully did our Browning, and he was so sweet in that after 3 weeks, he said, "May I call you Virginia?" Because he had until then been calling me very punctiliously Miss Dickinson, as of course I called him Sir, as you did to all of them. There were classes for both French and Latin unseens, to which I have to admit I didn't pay an awful lot of attention. And yes, Jim, John, Alan, John Christie. Oh, Janet! Janet Carlton, of course, who taught us Scott and Robert Burns, who else? And was very fierce, but an absolute delight. And again, I was extremely lucky that I knew her already and John Carlton. Janet had been at Somerville with my mother. And she was an absolute dear because she included me in absolutely everything. And if she and John were giving an evening party or a reception, she would send a message around saying, "Could I please go and give her female support? Anyone less in need of female support than Janet is very, very hard to imagine." But there we are. So I think that was all of them. There was a music side as well that came in from time to time. There was the competition, college music competition. At least, I am not sure with that one if it was only college or inter-house. But anyway, Mr. Burt was so excited to have a soprano to play with, which was a bit different, that he made me do it. And I did actually win. But there were also very strange oddities from time to time, like lamprobatics, which I understand has rather sort of gone out of favour again, but Martin Rogers was dead keen on it and revived it, and it was the most ludicrous race on the Thames. But you had to be really silly about it, so that half of them were wearing pyjamas or fur coats and things. And I was taken as cox, and I had never coxed a boat in my life before. But there it is, you do what you're told to do. So I did it, and I hate to say it, we won.
You must have, I mean, you talk very warmly of Martin Rogers, and he wasn't really your housemaster.
Well, he sort of was.
He was at the same time in that role. Can you say a bit more about the role he played?
Oh, Martin was wonderful. He is on record as saying later he has never laughed so much in a term as he did when I was there. Because, of course, I didn't know any of the school rules. So I was always doing the most outrageous things, like walking through the dormitories at night in order to take the quickest route back, and having guests in my room until 11 o'clock at night, and Martin would stick a head round the door and say, and the boy in question would run very swiftly, and I would say, "Oh, good night, Martin, how nice to see you." And likewise, I had no idea about visiting hours in other houses. And I ended up with a group from the English Seventh in Grants. Was it? Yes, it was Grants. Whose housemaster at that point happened to be Foxy Martin, who I also knew slightly. And, I mean, we were so pure and innocent. We were actually, really, truly, all discussing Yeats at about 11:30. We really were. And there was a bang on the door, and, of course, all the Grants boys turned green. I was beaming, because I said, "Oh, I've got a message for you from Erica Thompson, who had been the headmaster's wife when Foxy was teaching at Aysgarth Prep School many, many years before. And I had just seen her again, because my father also taught there. And she'd said, 'Oh, well, if you're going to Westminster and you see Foxy, do give him my love.' So, of course, I promptly did. And I was escorted politely from the house and told, you know, 'You really shouldn't have been here.' And I said, 'Oh, I'm terribly sorry, but nobody's told me anything.' At which she said, 'Well, I think you'd better come to lunch tomorrow.' Which I did. And all the rest of them were sitting there going, 'My God, what is this?' But no, one just sort of did it, as I say. You just sort of had to.
Did you feel at all in any way that you were a sort of trailblazer for what would ultimately become Westminster's co-educational sixth form?
No, not at all. The whole circumstances of my going there were so bizarre, and it was all really a personal arrangement with Martin Rogers. I don't believe my father ever paid any fees. But technically, they did have to have a meeting to overrule a statute from Elizabeth I, which said that women were not allowed. So this woman was, after that. But there were occasional girls coming in on a daily basis from St Paul's to do sciences, because Westminster's labs were better. But no, I never regarded myself in that way at all. I think it probably helped that I had an older brother. I knew a great many of his friends. And it never really struck me that there I was, the only girl among boys. It just wasn't relevant at all.
Do you think it was perhaps more challenging for some of the staff than it was for the boys?
Quite possibly. Yes, well, Mr. Christie, plainly, was a bit bouleversé. I knew Jim Cogan, I knew John Field, so they were okay. Alan Howarth was the sweetest, easiest person. And I got to know his wife also. So it would be interesting to know what they thought. John just regarded me as the, you know, sheep of the field. He knew me perfectly well. Jim was very accommodating. Alan was just sweet and polite, and so it went from there. I did, I must admit, find the marking system quite bizarre. I was not used to getting essays and things back saying alpha plus minus, alpha query plus, gamma. I don't think I ever got that bad. I am enormously proud of the fact that just once, from Jim Cogan, I got a higher mark than Stephen Polyakov. And that was a moment of deep smugness. He may have hated me, but he never gave the signs. And no, you see, everybody was extraordinarily accommodating and nice, as were the rest of the class, and they just, all of them, treated me as another pupil. The fact that I was not in uniform, nay, even in skirts, didn't really seem to register much. Waiting outside the dining hall, that was nervy. I was always right on my own. But for the rest, no.
What did you wear?
I tended to wear good old jerseys and skirts. Good, practical, sensible clothing. And also warm, because it was the winter. But definitely not wild minis or anything like that, because that simply wasn't my style wherever I was. I did wear skirts or pinafore dresses or whatever was the fashion at the time for lessons, but almost always in jeans, come the evening, of course. But nobody, again, made any fuss about that at all. I think I looked respectable. And that was okay. I did get given a third scarf at that one point. That was very nice. I liked that. I wasn't entitled to it in the very least. But I wore it with enthusiasm because it was like a blanket. They're huge.
They are. They are. On station afternoons, for example, what would you
free time.
Be doing?
Free time.
Anything you liked?
Anything I liked. Sometimes, if somebody had specifically asked me to, I would go up to Vincent Square and watch football with, I must say, a stunning lack of enthusiasm and understanding. I understand rugby more than I understand football. But generally, it was really when I caught up with all the reading that I hadn't done before hitting this amazing academic level that I hit. So it was busy. Or I might be helping Jane in the kitchen, doing things with the children, something like that. There was one absolutely heavenly afternoon when they had indeed all gone off. And I had gone down to the kitchen and said to Jane, "So, what are you doing for the party this evening?" She said, "What? Well, you're giving a party for the first 11. "Am I? Martin never said anything about that." At which point, we set to and made a perfectly splendid shopping list. And she got on the telephone and she said, "Martin is going to pay for this." And I was sent to Harrods, to the Army and Navy, in a taxi, please note, to collect absolutely everything that we needed. And we laid on the most fantastic, as usual, champagne party. But it was hilarious, and poor Martin looked so embarrassed when he came back and said, "Oh, didn't I mention it? Oh, I'm so sorry." Jane and I said, "That's all right, we've had a lovely time."
You mentioned Little Khmer.
Yes.
And I wonder what memories you have of the Abbey and school services in the Abbey and events in the Abbey.
That it was very awe-inspiring and beautiful, and I felt extremely privileged to be in it, and walking through Little Cloister and that is just so wonderful, and Fountain Court and all that. I'm not religious in the least, but I loved it. And I particularly loved Compline because it was candlelit and just utterly beautiful and tranquil, and not many people went. But I definitely appreciated that enormously. It was a big jump from morning assembly in the gym at my grammar school.
And did you feel part of those occasions, like Latin prayers? Or
Yes. Not the first time, when I felt most peculiar. But, yes, after a couple of repeats, you just were part of it and did it. And again, with Latin prayers, I did consciously have the thought, you know, this is bizarre. No other girl has ever done this. And this is me. And I suppose I felt rather proud of that.
And, of course, John Carlton presiding over all of that. How do you describe his style?
Good heavens, what a question. desire is not the word I want. But he was incredibly easy and tolerant and smiling. And I think he exuded a wonderful combination of total competence and a big sense of humour. I can't think of anything that would have rattled him. My brother, when he was praefectus, managed to acquire keys, as far as I can tell, to the whole of the building, and came and went at his ease. Gate hours for him, no chance. And I'm perfectly certain that John knew, but trusted him and just left it. Probably said on his last day, could you give me the keys back? But almost might not have done. And he and Janet just made the most wonderful couple. I mean, some people were terrified of them both. More Janet than John, I think. But I never was. Not in the least. They were just terrific.
And how much contact did you have with the rest of the school beyond those, the English Seventh and those who taught you?
Remarkably little. In fact, probably almost none. I mean, one saw them at meals and in the Abbey and that kind of thing, but not often to talk to. I knew some of the juniors in college, of course, because one was always tripping over them. But really, there wasn't time. I was working, as I say, harder than I ever worked at Oxford. And it was up at dawn and, oh God, I haven't read T.S. Eliot yet this morning. That kind of thing. And then essays or translations or whatever in the evenings. We did, but again, it was always with members of the English Seventh, go out to the theatre occasionally. Occasionally, daringly, even to a pub. I'm not sure if that was allowed, but we did. But no, I suspect most of the school looked amazed on the first day and thought, what is this alien penguin? And then just forgot it.
What was London like at the time? Because we have this vision of London in the 60s as being this very exciting place. Were you able to sample that? Or?
Well, not really much more than I already had. Whenever we did have school trips from my grammar school up to do something worthy, like go to the Tower of London or something, I tended to slope off with my mother's shopping list for what she wanted from Soho. And would get back on the coach in the evening reeking of garlic and cheeses and this and that and say, oh yeah, was it interesting? And it was a question. It was interesting trying to work out the connections between bits of London I knew, and then you'd suddenly walk into St James's Park and think, oh yes, this connects to that. So those sort of things were interesting. I think I really breezed through it all in the most astonishingly nonchalant way, in that there was a point during the term when John Field was utterly horrified that I had been up Victoria Street and into the Peabody Estate. And he sort of went, you mustn't go there. That's not good. You do not go in the Peabody Estate, because it was reputedly very rough and aggressive, but I can't say I ever had any bother. Wandered around. And I personally find it extraordinarily sad and really rather incomprehensible that nowadays builders on a site giving you a wolf whistle is regarded as a hate crime. This is surely an appreciation crime, if crime it be. I was always absolutely thrilled when somebody wolf whistled me. I thought it was fantastic. And usually whistled back. And nobody ever interfered with me or frightened me or threatened me in any way whatsoever.
I'm backtracking slightly. I was going to ask about the range of reading that you obviously had to do. Because you've mentioned so many authors already, and we're talking about a matter of a few weeks.
Yes.
In which you had to tackle all of that.
Yes.
And it's quite extraordinary to think, given what they read now, how much you were doing.
That is why I never had any trouble filling the time in the evenings or while other people were at stations. Because there was indeed all that lot. We covered Shakespeare, of course, Chaucer, Browning, Tennyson, George Eliot, T.S. Eliot even, Wordsworth, to name but a few.
You must have found when you did go up to Oxford that you had read a remarkable amount.
Yes.
Compared to some of the others who were there.
Yes, I did. It was a fantastic start. Of course, Westminster does fail in that it doesn't teach Anglo-Saxon. But then I'm not sure that Oxford does anymore. I do hope so. I loved doing that. But it was total immersion in literature that term. It was amazing.
And the teachers were all teaching their own particular specialism.
Yes.
And expertise.
Yes, they were. And it's difficult to remember, certainly, George Eliot was with Alan Howarth, Chaucer, and I think sometimes T.S. Eliot, in fact I'm pretty sure, was with Jim. John did Shakespeare, Wordsworth, and heaven knows whom else besides. And, as I said, dear Mr. Christie did Browning. But, yes, there was a heck of a lot to get through and read, and try and remember who was who. And then, of course, there was the actual thing of taking the entrance exam. Mm. And I took the Latin and the French unseens with everybody else up school, because for some reason they happened on the same day. But otherwise, the women's colleges and the men's colleges had their exams on different days. So I didn't go in with all the rest. I took my exams in matron. And John came and collected me in the morning in a very kind way and led me up there, and I think she gave me a mug of tea. And I was just sat down in a little room, and then John came in and said, right, there's your papers. See you in 3 hours. And the first paper, I looked at it, and I said, John, I can't do this. He said, yes, you can. If I were you, I'd read questions, as it were, 2, 5, and 7 again. I think you can bend them to what you know. And he was absolutely right. It was a masterclass in how to take exams. Never mind what the question is. Make it fit what your answer is. And you're up and away.
Of course, nowadays, that would be malpractice on his part.
I wouldn't have a word said against him. But I must say, I never believed for a minute that I would get in.
Do you remember what you wrote about when you twisted the questions to suit what you knew?
Not adequately for it to make any interesting sort of sense. Certainly I wrote about George Eliot. Certainly Wordsworth came in somewhere. I used to avoid Shakespeare as much as possible. Probably, given my tastes, Chaucer would have been in there somewhere. But no, I don't remember adequately, but it was 3 hours, 1 hour per essay, knock it out, girl.
And what else did the process involve? Were you then called up for an interview?
Yes.
What was that like as an experience?
Fairly daunting. In fact, yes, very, not least because Oxford was wrapped in fog. And walking from the station up to Somerville is a long way. But once I was there, they were all very nice, and I was deeply reassured that one of the fiercer tutors had actually known my mother, so I was very spoilt all the way by family connections carrying through. But again, you know, I thought, well, I did that, but I had absolutely no idea I would have got in.
It's interesting that, of course, at that time the distinction between the men's colleges and the women's colleges was so firm. And you mentioned they had the exams on different days. And,
yeah.
You know, there was sort of no sense of overlap at all, really.
No, there wasn't. And we lobbied successfully to change Somerville gate hours during the 3 years that I was there. So that by the end, anybody visiting, even unaccompanied, could come in up to 11 p.m. You could take people out through a back gate up to 2 in the morning. We then introduced a guests at breakfast rule, so that you only, should you want to, had to keep people hidden between 2 a.m. and 8 a.m. And no male porter is going to come around knocking on your door at that time of night, are they? So that sorted that one out. So I do generally think that the furore and fuss about co-ed colleges was really, by then, rather unnecessary. Because we all intermingled as much as we wanted. And the critical thing about Oxford is to get to know and get on with your college porter. Once you've done that, you're fine. I have told both sons who have gone to Oxford this simple fact and true. Just get to know the porter. They can fix anything. They know everything. And one evening I had stayed rather over the gate hours at Exeter with a friend from Westminster even. And he suddenly said, oh heavens, this is dire. Because they only had one gate. How pathetic. You had to go in past the porter's lodge. And dear Peter went to the porters and said, just a question. If I had a female hiding behind that buttress there, and I were to let her out of the gate, would you notice? And he said, no, of course not.
Did you remain good friends with a lot of Westminster boys at Oxford?
While I was at Oxford, yes. Most of us have all gone different ways now, but in actual fact, I was utterly delighted to get a Christmas card the other day from one Neil Margerison, who was in college when I was, though he was younger. And he has remained good friends with John Field all his life, and therefore he also sees my brother quite a bit. But I was very pleased to hear from him, and I, you know, if we overlap when we're in Northumberland, I see him. The said Peter at Exeter, I've lost. I don't know what's happened to him. Stephen Ruttle, of course, very eminent these days, I'm told. He was a junior, and we used to do babysitting together, actually. It was sweet. We sat there solemnly reading poetry together and commenting on what was what, and don't you think this, and maybe that. And he came down to stay, you know, on a weekend or something. But no, largely, that's all gone, which is maybe a shame, but actually I think life has to move on. I think it's not always a really good thing to cling to what happened then, kind of thing. I do not go back for Gordies or anything like that. I think I would be hard put to it to recognise most of my fellow Somervillians. One I have remained firm friends with always. But that's about it.
Did you feel at the time that, you know, your fellow Somervillians, knowing about your time at Westminster, were sort of treating you
differently
because of that?
I don't suppose they did know in the
least. Or did they not know at all about it?
No, I shouldn't think so.
Because I suppose the question is, did you tell people about that as part of...
Oh, no, not up front as a sort of gripping opening to conversation. It was more sort of, did you go to that awesome lecture this morning on Yeats? And they would say yes or no, or I spent an inordinate amount of time in Oxford actually doing music. There was usually a rehearsal for something every single night of the week, and performances at weekends, and I absolutely adored that. So I did expand a friendship very much into the music circles. But the brilliant thing about that was that any fool can sing, it doesn't matter what you're studying. And it was very egalitarian, you know, it was from all colleges, all sexes. I think there were two. And so that was really my sort of broadest university experience, I think. But I did thoroughly enjoy doing the English, and it's an awful treat to be able to sit and read books and feel that you're working, because it's such a pleasure to do. I also had great fun in my last year. You were able to choose a particular sector, and I chose Romantics, which meant I was doing medieval French and Wordsworth with one Jonathan Wordsworth, who was his grandson, maybe? Certainly related. He definitely was related, and I knew exactly where his holiday house was. So I rocked up for the first tutorial and said, "Ah, Jonathan, last time I saw you at Grassguards." "Good grief, so you did." Because this was also in Cumberland, where we always went for holidays, and it was a most outrageous farmhouse on the top of a mountain. I mean, his wife must have been a saint, because they had four children up there, and there was no road, there was nothing. You walked. But he had rented it for a number of years. So one got off on a very good footing for Wordsworth. It was great fun. And of course, all the other wretched tutees were going, "What?"
And of course, you already knew all about it from John Field.
Well, of course I did. Not to mention my father. I really couldn't have read any other subject. My mother read English at Somerville. My father read English at St. Catherine's, Cambridge. My brother read English at Trinity, Cambridge. I went back to Somerville. The books were all there, all over the house, some of them even usefully annotated first. So it was simply a complete part of our lives. Poor visitors who came, particularly, you know, young visitors, boyfriends, things like that, would be utterly baffled by the lunchtime conversation, because we would be throwing quotes at each other and references and everything else all over the place. And my father sadly grew very deaf, and you would ask him something and he wouldn't answer, and you didn't even know if the question had gone in. And then about 15 minutes later, when the conversation had moved on to something completely else, he would come up with exactly the right answer. But it was a bit like the Delphic Oracle. You had to be able to work back into your mind what you were talking about at that point, and then realise, yes, the wretched man is right again.
You mentioned the Delphic Oracle, and it reminds me that one thing we haven't asked you about for the tape yet is when you went on the Westminster Greek trip.
Oh, yes. Well, that again was awful family graft, so useful. We knew Ted and Dot Craven as friends, and had been borrowing their holiday cottage for years. And when my brother was going on the Greek trip anyway, because he was at the school, they suggested that I might like to go too. And yes, I did. And there were two other girls coming from St. Paul's. And so off we went. And it was absolutely marvellous. In fact, there's a wonderful thing about Theo's Inn. We'd all tucked up in our bunks and sleepers and all the rest, and Theo was on a bottom one, and he was reading. And he kept turning the pages over. And then suddenly he said, "Oh God! Oh God! No! Oh no! It's short stories!" And he had thought he was reading an Agatha Christie novel, and it was short stories, and he was outraged, having read the first three chapters and thinking, there's got to be a connection here somewhere, and suddenly finding that there wasn't. Dear Theo, he was great fun, as indeed was the entire Greek trip, and beautiful and wonderful, and I loved all the ruins and everything else, but I'm a particular fanatic of botany and flowers, and all the wild flowers at that time of year are just fabulous. So I ruined about three paperbacks, pressing flowers to take back from my mother, which actually worked quite well. The books were never the same. But, yes, I was very, very fortunate. But there was a very tense moment when we were in Rome and we were all being taken to see the Sistine Chapel. And I had, at that point, very short hair. And that was fortunate, because I was not correctly dressed for going into the Sistine Chapel as a female, because I was wearing jeans. Can't be done. So those charming boys seized me, dragged me aside, put a tie on me, combed my hair into a completely different shape. I borrowed a jacket from one Joe Earl. We went back, and I went straight in, which was fine, until it came to going to the lavatories on the way out, when I automatically aimed for the ladies, and was thrown out by a very large Italian minion. Worse than that, I was thrown into the gents, where all the boys and the staff were, happily peeing away. And I effaced myself with due speed, but it's not the sort of thing you've planned on somehow. But it was very, very, very funny.
How long were you away for? Because it must have taken...
It was 2 or 3 weeks. Something like that. Yes, I think it was probably nearer 3 than 2. It was a jolly good trip, anyhow. You got value for money in those days, not like these modern ones where they take you to Paris for a weekend or something. But, no, it was wonderful. And it sort of lives with you, doesn't it? You can go on envisaging these things. And the other exciting moments when your brother disappears down drains or up mountains and other such entertaining sideshows. But, oh, and it must be one of the only recorded occasions where virtue has been rewarded. We were supposed to be bicycling quite a long way somewhere. And for some reason there weren't enough bicycles. And with great nobility, I said, "No, that's all right. You have my bicycle, that's fine." And then the very desirable and swish tour guide, who was called Spiro, turned up on a Vespa scooter. And he said, "Oh, we can't leave you behind. Hop on the back." So I got a chauffeur-driven ride to everybody else's utter rage.
Did you feel that Theo was using the Greek trip as a moment for teaching his pupils in any sort of formal sense?
No.
Because it sounds like a wonderful holiday.
No, he wasn't. I think what he was doing, and did do, was instill a feeling for it. It wasn't a sort of specific, this happened this year, that happened that year. It was more, just think about what sort of things happened here. And look at it. And feel it. It was very much more that sort of thing. And it was wonderful. Because, of course, you did.
I know much more about Theo than I do about Ted Craven, actually. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about Ted.
That's not difficult. Theo was an extremely flamboyant character,
yeah.
I think you would agree.
Yeah.
And indeed, he ended up living in Godalming, just up the road. Ted was the archetypal classics master. He was small, he was quiet, he was really fairly reserved. His wife was the flamboyant opposite. So they made an absolutely splendid pair. But although I was dearly fond of him, it's very difficult to conjure up a character picture of Ted, because he really didn't seem to have one much.
To go back to college, did you feel part of college in a way?
Yes,
yeah.
Very definitely. No, I rarely penetrated any of these other terrifying places. But no, I identified totally with number three. That was it. And, you know, its systems, its staff, its layout, everything. That was home.
Who was Matron at the time? Do you remember?
The awful thing is, I can't remember her name. She was exceedingly nice, but I think, you see, I only really ever saw her when I was being ushered in to write exams. So my mind wasn't really on who she was. So no, I can't, I'm sure you could look it up. But I have absolutely no idea. How shameful.
The nice piece is you lived in number three, and Matron presumably lived at the Great College Street end of the dormitory.
Yes.
That's where she lives now.
Yes.
And
and up at the top.
Yeah, up at the top. And did John Field live?
Oh, John?
As well?
John, yes. You could get to him from outside without having to come into Dean's Yard. Yes, he had a flat on about the second floor. But yes, that end. So that when I was going to see him, I could either press the doorbell, which usually didn't work, or throw rocks at his window and shout. And he would press the necessary button to let me in.
And so in a way, you know, the staff who lived there were overlapping with the staff who taught you and who knew well
anyway.
Very
much so, yes. And Ted and Dot were running a sort of...
Barton Street.
Yes, that's right, in Barton Street, a sort of slightly auxiliary boarding house. So I could always drop in on them if I wanted to.
Do you remember who else was a college tutor, if any other of the teaching staff were attached to the house?
No. I suspect they left me well alone.
Yes, probably.
Swift evasion system there. Because it was such a very odd system that obviously I was part of the school, but I wasn't. So, normal rules and things, yes, I did gradually begin to learn that they were supposed to apply to me, but an awful lot of them didn't. And so you sort of went around and did what you liked when you liked, a lot of the time. And I think I got away with it because they would just think, oh, that wretched girl, she doesn't know what on earth she's meant to be doing, but she doesn't seem to be doing any harm, so she might as well get on with it. But, no, I don't recall any other staff at all. I was, as I say, just so focused, because one had to be, on the work, your actual teachers, and indeed on the dear Rogers family, that kind of absorbed every moment of the day, and quite a lot of the night.
And the rooms that you were taught in, were they those first floor rooms in Ashburnham House?
Yes, I think they mostly were. Some were in strange places, and I couldn't tell you where. I don't think the language lessons were in Ashburnham. John and Jim certainly were. Mr. Christie, I think, was in Ashburnham Library. And I'm going to say I've forgotten the name now. It that did... Howarth, that's the one. He was in Liddell's. He was in a down floor room in Liddell's, which was actually pitch dark and freezing cold, so they were the bad lessons.
And if you needed the loot, did you have to go back to number three?
I suppose I did. Yes. But I don't know. I've grown up in some pretty weird and outrageous places in my time, so you just accommodate. Yes, I think I always did. I can't think where else.
Headmaster's house, maybe.
Well, Janet would have welcomed me happily, but it was rather further to go, usually. So, and anyway, she might have been busy, and she was not a person that you interrupted. Very much not.
Because those rooms in Ashburnham House on the first floor, which are wonderfully civilised places in which to spend a lesson, and one sees the odd photograph of English lessons being taught in there. Because now it's all library and it's all a bit more sanitised. It's a bit more sanitised now than it used to be.
Oh dear.
But what can you say about the sort of atmosphere of the room creating the sense of the atmosphere of the lesson, really?
I don't think you could have bettered it. They were nicely proportioned, beautiful rooms. They had books in for a start, which is always a good thing. And no, there were very few of us, of course. Classes, from what I had been used to at grammar school, were drastically reduced. So it was, except when either John or Jim lost their temper, almost family atmosphere, and after all, people do lose their tempers even in families. But it's a bit like the feeling I got when going into Abbey. I just thought, this is a place of learning, this is what I've come to do, and this is deeply conducive to it. So I'd better pay attention and do it.
You don't remember why they lost their temper occasionally, do you?
Oh, yes. Jim mercifully never lost his temper with me because he could be very fierce. It was someone else who turned in a sort of gamma minus. John Field, who, as you will know, is a bit of a dramatist at times, had arranged to take us out to a performance, I think, of Hamlet, with Ian McKellen, who was the total rising star at the time. And it was awesome. And then we all drifted back in ones and twos. And he waited in the morning until we were all seated respectfully. And then he swept into the room like a whirlwind in his gown, which does help the whirlwind effect, and gave us the most tremendous telling off. That not one of us had said thank you for arranging it. Well, the simple truth is that we hadn't actually seen him afterwards. But all the same, we were all utterly guilt-stricken and said, oh, sorry, 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 sir. Yes, it was absolutely wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful. And he stormed out, slammed the door very dramatically. We all thought, well, what happens now? 2 seconds elapsed. He then walked in, calm and smiling, and said, well, shall we do some Wordsworth? Or whatever it was. And it was all over. But he'd got it out of his system. And it was indeed a very useful lesson. I hadn't said thank you. And was ashamed. Mr. Christie, of course, never lost his temper with anyone. Janet could be sharp, but always totally justified. Alan Howarth was also extremely gentle, actually. I can't imagine how he coped in politics. But, no, they were lovely. Not one bad one.
Did you feel at all that... I mean, this probably applied more to the boys in the English 7th who come up through the school, that there was any sense of rivalry between subjects going on, certainly with the classical 7th?
I didn't really come across that much, no. There was a perfectly healthy rivalry within the English 7th, because there was this hideous tradition that you had to read your marks out. So everybody knew who had been slacking and who had been slaving. I never got any sense that any one subject thought they were superior to the others. If anything at all, I think because I was on the arts side, sciences were somewhat looked down upon. You know, they were a bit new. But nothing more than that.
Because it's interesting, one sort of gathers that 10, 20 years earlier, that feeling was still very strong about classics having this sort of superior cachet.
Well, yes, I'm sure there was some of that. Equally, I would have been a very bad character to try and put that across, because before he switched to English, my father had read classics. My brother had done classics up to A-level. Again, it was just like English literature, washed all over you all the time. I mean, my father translated the Aeneid, Aristophanes. As a child, I was proofreading it all. So I, you know, if somebody had tried to be superior and say they were a classicist, I'd say, oh, nuts, you're just like my father then.
Did you do any theatre yourself? Did you do any drama, plays at school?
No.
You probably didn't have time.
Well, I didn't have time, but more to the point, it is absolutely not what I would enjoy. I was perfectly happy to sing for them in the carol concert and the music competition, but for the rest, no. I do not put myself on the stage.
You'd better just say for the recording what happened at the carol service.
Oh, well... The carol service was quite something and was, in those days, held at St Margaret's. And John Field had decided that I had to read a lesson. And Mr Burt had decided that I had to sing any soprano recitatives and also be in sole control of any descants. And so, I must say, reading the lesson was terrifying, but I did it. Singing the descant was just a downright challenge, and I was perfectly determined to make it audible to the back of St Margaret's, which is not small. And John was sitting right at the back and confirms that I did. And as he was leaving, he came up behind two people, one saying to the other, "Extraordinary voice that for a boy." And John, with awful glee, walked past them and said, "It would have been, if it were." So, yes, in retrospect, that was a most satisfactory occasion, but a little bit stressful at the time.
I'm going to ask about the carol service, because we've just had the carol service 2016 version. One does hear stories about the behaviour of some of the boys at events like that in the past.
Really?
And indeed, I remember it from my own day. Was there any...
Nothing that I noticed, but I may have been preoccupied with my own worries. No, certainly not.
Maybe that came later.
I think it did. I think you were getting decadent.
I think maybe in my generation were the problem.
Certainly, my brother never, ever mentioned anything like that. No, if you were in Abbey or if you were in St Margaret's, you behaved, and there was no two ways about it.
I think maybe no one would have dared under John Carlton.
No.
Later on, I think maybe things...
Maybe things softened up a bit.
But you mentioned that there were, you know, champagne parties and that there were events.
Well, I don't know. Any event particularly centred around Martin seemed to end up with champagne. It just did. So, undoubtedly, we will have gone back for some after the carol service, in the aftermath of this ridiculous first 11 party, sometimes for no apparent reason at all. Certainly after Little Kamam. I remember a very good one after that. Or sometimes it was just he sort of felt like it and gathered a few people around, and in particular if his aunt was visiting, who was indeed the most daunting and terrifying female. I would love to say that she smoked a pipe. I think she certainly smoked cheroots. I'm not at all sure that a pipe didn't come into it somewhere. But anyway, I was usually dragged in as sort of padding on these occasions and was only too happy to oblige. It was very good.
We always get the impression that the Carltons were, you know, sort of great society hosts too, and that they were very glamorous people.
They weren't in the least glamorous. But yes, they were sociable, very definitely. And I think it was probably, because he was a very subtle man, a clever way of John's to keep his finger on what everybody was doing and what was happening. And you could do that very discreetly by mixing up different members of staff or whatever in a sort of informal situation. But in fact, he was well on the job.
And we hear that he was terribly well connected too, so there would be exciting people from outside. I wondered if
I don't remember any of those. I think he probably was, but then so was Janet. Again, this sounds terrible. Because of my upbringing, I never really cared much about people's backgrounds. The world was full of leading actors and painters and thises and thats and composers and so on, and to me they were just people. My children are absolutely furious that I never continued the friendship once we grew up with Daniel Day-Lewis. He was the younger child of my godmother, Jill Day-Lewis. We knew him as a child. He was fine. He was just a wretched little tot. He's rather bigger nowadays. And very sweet, though, because we were invited to a memorial do for Jill when she died. And without any prompting at all, Dan just jumped up, came over, gave me the most huge hug and kiss and said, "Oh, fantastic, how nice to see you. Haven't seen you for so long." I thought, gosh, that's nice when you've got so many other people to deal with. So I think my brother and I, both of us, have really never taken any notice of anybody's class or caste or what they do. What matters is, are they interesting? And do we like them? And it may be a Northumbrian shepherd, indeed, it often is. Or it may be John Craxton, or it may be Cecil Day-Lewis. It doesn't really matter. Or Leonard Woolfe, of course. He comes in too along the wayside, but nothing to do with Westminster.
It may be that's an attitude which helped you to thrive at Westminster.
I think it almost certainly did. I think it did very much engender a feeling of, you look at the person, it doesn't matter where they come from, their background, just who are they? Are they interesting? Are they nice? And they could be the dustman's son or the Duke of Westminster's. It wouldn't matter.
One thing I was going to ask about, obviously you knew John Field very, very well, and John Carlton as well, and of course they were both extremely interested in Westminster's history.
Yes, indeed.
And, you know, John Carlton knew everything there was to know at an antiquarian level about the school and the abbey. Did they ever share that with you at that time?
John Carlton didn't. John Field did invite me and, curiously enough, my mother on a lovely private evening exploring the Abbey with various other people, and it was absolutely magical because there was nobody there at all, and there were only about six of us, and he was telling us things, but again, mostly it was just looking at it, absorbing it. And so, yes, he did, and ever so often he puts one right on things, as is his wont. But John, I didn't come across him in that sort of context, I think.
Anything else? I think we've covered the ground. There's always a few questions I like to ask at the end.
Oh, go on. Be a devil.
So, well, the first question that I always ask towards the end is, would you just tell us a little bit about what happened to you after university? And I don't know if Westminster ever sort of played a role in your later life in an unexpected way or just in a...
After university was a bit strange. I had got my degree. I had thought of going to the Royal College of Music for a one-year performance course. And then I suddenly thought, good grief, they have 13-week terms. I'm used to 8-week terms. That won't do. And I ended up, by a chain of very curious circumstances, taking a job housekeeping a Scottish island in the Hebrides. And it was basically because the wife of the laird was also patron of the Schola Cantorum that I sang in at Oxford. And she always had a stooge to look after the children. I mean, she had six of them, though three were fairly grown up. But there were always endless visitors. And a friend of mine recommended me for this, saying, oh, you'll love it. The island's full of sheep. You can't go wrong. So we went and saw her, and she took me on. And so I spent the summer straight after university there, looking after innumerable children and retrieving them from roofs and covering up when they had broken into the gun cupboard and things like that. It was all very exciting. But then the household all then went back to London and Bath. They had a house in the Royal Crescent. At which point their then permanent housekeeper fell ill and retired. And Lady Strathcona didn't know quite what to do. And I was totally at a loose end. I have never had a career in mind. And we sort of looked at each other and said, well, would you? Would you? And so I came home just long enough to gather up a decent pile of winter clothes and then went back to live in the big house on the island. And my remit there was to work through the entire house, making good, which included everything from oiling the books in the library to darning his lordship's socks, literally. Also, which they hadn't mentioned, paying the island's wages. That was always an interesting one. Exercising the dog. Generally, just keeping the place good, and if anybody turned up, you looked after them. And I loved it dearly. Oh, and I had to look after a weather station. That was guessing time. I know nothing about weather. But anyway, they seemed to think they wanted my returns, so I sent them. I am proud to say that my telephone number was Colonsay 1. And you still wound a handle to get the exchange on the island. And you would get Flora. And you'd say, Flora, can you put me through to Doogie? And there'd be a pause. And she said, I've just seen him go by. I think he was going to the McCrimmon's. I'll put you through there and we'll see. And so you zigzag all over the island to find people. You never needed to know their numbers. The snag with this was that, of course, Flora listened in to absolutely everything. And I had to tell the factor, who came over occasionally, that he absolutely must not say anything about anybody, because it would be all around the island in seconds. So if he said somebody was a lazy so-and-so and hadn't mended the estate car, wham, it would be there. So I taught him that. But it did have this marvellous advantage that you never needed to know anybody's phone number and you would track them down. And because Arthur and I had got to know each other in Oxford and he was still living in the south, every so often we wanted to talk to each other. But this was not easy, because you had to summon Flora and say, could you put me across to Campbelltown, which was on the mainland? And then you spoke to Campbelltown and said what you wanted. Of course she listened in. So that when poor Arthur eventually visited the island, you know, there was practically a line-up to see if he'd do. It was immense, and I stayed there for very nearly a year. And I must say, I was tempted to stay forever. But, oh, I don't know, people were moaning and saying, you've got this degree and you aren't doing anything with it, and you ought to come back, and you ought to do this, and you ought to do that. And I was thinking, well, ought I? Wouldn't I just love it here? But it was time to move on. I've never, ever regretted it. It was wonderful. I mean, you don't often get full charge of a 24-bedroom house. And the one thing I did not maintain was the boiler, because it was an ex-boiler from a ship, because you needed it with that many bathrooms. And a splendid stalwart came and stoked it up from time to time. But, you know, if he forgot, you didn't have any hot water, and that was that. The power went off on a whim, according to when the chap who ran the generator chose to turn it off. So you might find yourself at the far end of this house suddenly in the pitch dark, and grope your way sadly back to where you wanted to be. But this was just all good fun. And I also was left in possession of the house cow. I wasn't, sadly, allowed to look after the cow myself, because it was the province of a man called Duncan, who was very sweet and probably nearer 80 than not. And he brought me the entire produce of the house cow every day. That's an awful lot of milk for one person. And I did say, look, surely somebody else on the island could use some of this, would like it. Oh, no. Because this is the laird's cow, so it comes to this house, and that's that. And then he came one day and said he'd got a problem with the cow. And I said, well, how do I get a vet? No, it's not that. We went round a lot of puzzling problems until finally he said that the light bulb in its shed had gone pop, so he couldn't see to milk it. And because I was the stand-in for the laird, it was my duty to go and put a light bulb in. It's absolutely wonderful. Priceless stuff. I'm afraid it's probably all greatly changed now, but it was wonderful. And then I came back and discovered that I actually had to sort of get a job, which was a serious mistake. So I actually then spent a few years doing antique restoration and china mending and things like that. And then, of course, I made the ultimate mistake of getting married. And I've never worked since, except for running a small holding, feeding the entire flock and everything else. But, oh, and, of course, writing my children's essays. When the eldest went to St. Andrews and read French and Italian and was not infrequently demanding expert advice on his essays, I rather think he also did so when he was still at school, but we keep quiet about that. The second one made the enormous mistake of reading Japanese, so I was no use to him at all on that. except when he wrote his final dissertation, which was mercifully largely in English. So I proofread that and said, the Japanese is up to you, don't know. And the youngest one did theoretical physics. And I'm absolutely no good at that at all. So that settled that lot. And they're now all doing amazing things. So I'm not required to write their essays anymore.
And then our final question is, is there anything that you wanted to say that we haven't given you the opportunity to say?
I don't think so. I think we've covered an enormous amount of ground, probably infinitely more than you want. If I were you, I'd edit it pretty briskly.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
A pleasure.